Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world.
Episode 7. This is part 2. We have had to split the content up due to the sheer amount of news and events and previews that we are wishing to discuss this week. Let's get straight into the Women's Victoria Tri-Series. Zimbabwe were champions and went undefeated and also cleaned up the awards in the series. The player of the series was Aneshi Mashangwe. She scored 77 runs at 25 with 7 wickets at an average of 7 with the ball. The top run scorer as well was Zimbabwean Modesta Mupachkwa, with 105 runs at 26, with a top wicket taker, Tasmin Granger, finishing with 10 wickets at 5.5. Nick, you watched this tournament a little bit more than we did. I did catch a little bit. The stream was quite good, and full credit to everyone involved with all of that. But it did look like the Zimbabwe were in complete control. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, they'll be very encouraged by this performance. Going into the women's double qualifier in May, which is qualifying for the women's 50-over World Cup and the 20-over World Cup, and that's for the Africa region. So, I think their bowling especially was very good. Their seamers just look to have that extra yard of pace, which especially in women's cricket can make all the difference. The fielding I thought was excellent, which I guess is reflected in the Best Fielder Award going to Zimbabwean Ashley Ndaria. They were just definitely the better team, which is interesting because Uganda managed to spring an upset over Zimbabwe at the last African qualifier and progress at their expense. But they had a lot of trouble against them in this tournament. It was a very low-scoring tournament. I think Lugogo Oval looked a bit slow, the pitch there, and then the highest total being 118. No one scored a 50, which can potentially favour Uganda because their batting is their weakness. So they're definitely stronger at maybe bowling teams out and getting a low total. But the Zimbabweans just were too good. The Ugandans were missing a few first-choice players, like Gertrude Kandiru, who was working, and that's the thing, at this level, they're not professionals. So, I think it was a fair reflection of the quality of the teams on display. And Kenya really struggled. They didn't win a game. They did push Zimbabwe in their first match, but, other than that, they didn't really get close. A couple of standout performers other than the ones you mentioned. For Uganda, Immaculate Nakasuyi, the all-rounder, with her off-spin, she took 6 wickets and she scored 74 runs at an average of 37 and a strike rate of 109, which is better than almost anyone else. And she actually hit 3 sixes, which, when there are only 6 sixes in the whole tournament, shows how important she is. Konsia Weko was the Ugandan leg spinner. She only took 3 wickets, but she had the astonishing economy rate of 2.25, including 6 maidens, which, there were only 12 maidens in the whole tournament. So she'll be a key player for them going into the women's double qualifier. And I was also really impressed with Sarah Walaza. She only played a couple of games, but she looks like a promising prospect. She's a pace bowler and she's really tall and bouncy and managed to use the angles really well.
Once again, Nick, going above and beyond there with the coverage of the Women's Victoria Tri-Series. What an asset you are to the emerging cricket team. Tim, the tournament was streamed on YouTube, which is a huge deal for associate cricket, let alone a tournament in Africa between 3 women's sides. Just how important is just getting, just even if it is the minimum of 2 cameras and some comms, just how important is it for the case of associate cricket in both men's and women's sides of things to push things forward?
Look, it's a huge spoke in the wheel, really, that supports the game's development, that you're trying to build heroes in the game, and if it's only being seen by those at the ground, which is of course great to build stories that way, but that's a fairly limited audience there, about getting these streams together. And from what I watched, it was a 2 camera stream from elevated positions with commentary between 1 and 2 people. Bright, breezy, cheap and cheerful, however you want to say it, but look, it was watchable and you can appreciate the effort going into it, and especially countries as vast as they are across Africa, long distances apart and difficulty of traveling, the chance for people to log on to smartphones, as everybody has these days, or a lot of people have, I think was great. Just a little look into the future of what can be done for not a lot of cash. From the looks of it, it would have been just an easy switcher between the 2 cameras, maybe even by the 2 guys that were commentating. Score was up. Great. Perfect. There we are, watching women's cricket from Africa, and we're able to talk about it, and that's the whole point of it.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more, Tim. I think, yeah, it was a great effort from Cricket Uganda in both in organising the tournament and, yeah, as you say, putting together a very watchable stream with, yeah, two cameras, commentary. It's not that hard. You know, ICC, take note. Other boards, take note. It's not that difficult. And maybe a quick shout out to Hisense, who Uganda roped into donating some smartphones. You're mentioning the possibility of watching the game on smartphones, Tim, and they're giving them to the player of the match, the leading run scorers, all of those ladies got a free smartphone. And we got to watch some cricket, which was really good.
Yeah, we can thank the Deep End Sports Media service for bringing those streams to life via YouTube. And yeah, it is a good benchmark for a lot more global competitions in the associate sphere that haven't been streamed with this much access and ease. It's definitely a benchmark for others to sort of strive to in the future. So a massive pat on the back to everyone involved with that competition there. Zimbabwe were involved in some international cricket on the men's side of things. They've just started a one-day international series against the United Arab Emirates. The first match is done and dusted, and it was a fairly comfortable win for the Zimbabwean side. UAE actually made a practice stop on the way to Zimbabwe by playing Oman as well. There is plenty to go on here, boys, but it does look like Zimbabwe are going to look a little bit too strong for UAE heading into this series.
Oh, look, this is a great event for the UAE to be going in a bilateral. I know that's a dirty word, but I'm not reading too much into this. We've seen them perform excellently in the World Cup qualifiers against Zimbabwe themselves, but I think what is probably more of a worry for Dougie Brown is just the lack of consistency. You know, the talent across that squad is not the issue, but he just needs his players, especially his key players, to be able to stand up more consistently and being putting the lower order under pressure like they were. What were they? Were they 50 for 7 or something at one stage to scrape back to get to 120-odd? Obviously, it's not good enough in an ODI, but look, I don't think it's too reflective of the team itself.
Yeah, I think if I'm Dougie Brown, I'd be a little bit worried about their form, actually. They didn't play an official UAE side against the Americans, but the USA beat various development and other sort of UAE squads, which had a lot of their first team players in them, and they won pretty comfortably in most of their games. And then in that stopover in Oman sprung an upset as well. So the UAE, as you say, Tim, they're a bit enigmatic. They need to really play with a bit more discipline, maybe. And I guess, yeah, if I'm Dougie Brown, I'd be a bit worried about that.
Yeah, and also don't forget the tour match beforehand with the chairman's team or whatever, that they did get up over them, chasing down 232 in, you know, 40 in the 47th over. So, you know, as Dougie Brown has spoken about in interviews afterwards about adapting to conditions, but it's just it's that consistency at this level that's going to be the difference, you know. And like you was talking about in part one, Nicholas, about how the fact that UAE, you know, how they got out of World Cricket League 2 and into the World Cup qualifier and whatnot. It is really a game of inches, you know, around this level. So the consistency is going to be what keeps teams up in leagues or gets team up leagues. And as you said, I think he will be a little bit worried because he's been with the team long enough now for them to be settled with him and their roles on the side. So I can imagine he's probably a little bit frustrated.
Well, a man who is helping out Dougie Brown at UAE is Graham Cramer, which is a fascinating backstory for this series. Of course, he was the captain of the Zimbabwean side during their World Cup qualification campaign last year. Of course, they didn't qualify for the World Cup, and now he's been blueprinting a way to beat his old national team. He has moved to Dubai to be closer with his partner, who is a pilot for Emirates. And it's an interesting backstory that, you know, he was pushed out during the clean out of Zimbabwean cricket after the qualifiers. So he's definitely got all the motivation he needs to blueprint a few wins for the UAE. Surely he doesn't need a inspirational talk from anybody. He's got that up his sleeve, Nick.
Yeah, as you say, he was pushed out during that Red Wedding-esque mass sacking.
Very topical, Nicholas. Very topical.
Oh, yes. Yes, the new season's coming out soon. Actually, while we're over in Namibia, so I'm not sure how we'll be able to get our fix.
Well, lucky you've got all those hours sitting in airports on the way home to be able to watch it.
But, yeah, so he was pushed out in that disaster. They actually sacked head coach Heath Streak, batting coach Lance Klusener, bowling coach Douglas Hondo, fielding coach Walter Chawaguta, fitness coach Sean Bell, team analyst Stanley Chioza, Zimbabwe A coach Wayne James, under 19 coach Stephen Magongo, and the convener of selectors Tatenda Taibu, all in one go. And as well as kicking them all out, a couple of days later, they then rehired them for a day and then sacked them again. So it was a bit of a circus and, you know, some very nasty accusations, and, you know, racism against Heath Streak from some administrators, and the chairman, who's still there, Tevenga Mukulani, described the UAE as amateurs, and the result, you know, Zimbabwe beating them to qualify, was a foregone conclusion. And so, yeah, a lot of bad blood between the administration and the players, who actually weren't even being paid properly during the tournament. They were being paid 40% of their salaries, and Heath Streak took a massive pay cut as well so that the players would get anything, really. So it was a bit of a mess, and so I can definitely see Kramer being very unhappy and wanting to get a bit of revenge.
And let's not forget either that the most viewed video during the World Cup qualifier was actually Myrna's,
Graham's wife.
Yes, was the, I think it was either the tie against Scotland, where the caught behind. I think that they all go nuts. Either that or the one-run win against Afghanistan, which when you go back and look at it and you think about this so-called foregone conclusion, they should have beaten UAE. But, you know, they saved the match against Scotland after being in a position they should have lost. They were able to beat Afghanistan after coming back from a position where they were losing. I think they, in the end, they didn't perform too badly in a tournament with some great teams. And to have that kind of response, well, we've seen what's happened since then. They also lost their managing director, and you know, to blame all of the issues on Zimbabwean cricket, on them not making the World Cup, was beyond a fallacy, in that, you know, the $1 million they would have got for making it compared to the $9 million that they've got in debt linked to banks that are run by some of the board members. You know, it's you know, you just feel for the Zimbabwe cricket community, the greater community, shall we say, when you see the crowds in Harare. Anyway, but I love that that was the most viewed video, was from her camera phone in the crowd. But yeah, it's a bit heart-wrenching when you see those photos of them in their Zim shirts after the UAE game, just absolute, well, distraught.
Yeah, and I guess it just goes back to that you know, recurring theme with associate and emerging cricket, you know, down at this level. As we saw with the World Cup qualifiers, there's really not a lot of difference between the teams ranked, you know, 9, 10, all the way down to 16, 17, 18. There's really very not much difference between any of them in terms of quality. And it was a really good tournament, and it was a fantastic advertisement for the game. And, yeah, it was a real shame that the ICC wasn't broadcasting that, and the only way we could see that moment was on the camera phone of the captain's wife. You know, that's not good enough, honestly.
Well, a tree falling in the woods comes to mind, doesn't it? But I think as you're talking about the pressure that that Zimbabwe were under, and well, so not so much the pressure they're under, but how close the teams are together. I think it was Dougie Brown, actually, in an interview before the tournament, saying he was really interested to see how these full member nations would go under this type of pressure, because associate nations are used to playing for their supper and knowing that if we'd lose this, we're potentially out of jobs. And it was interesting to see how that played out, rather poetically in the end, that it was UAE playing Zimbabwe in the end that precluded the host from being able to participate in the World Cup. So, yeah, it's just interesting how that by the ICC moving the bar up for the 10-team World Cup, and how it exposes how similarly levelled a lot of these teams are. Like, as you're talking about 16th and 18th, you know, Hong Kong beat Afghanistan during that tournament. You know, that says enough.
Yeah, for me, I just can't go past that Sikandar Raza rant at the end of the tournament that really, I think it kind of left the ICC a little bit red-faced, because I think they just assumed that he'd come up and accept things and just give the most sort of vanilla speech. She ended up calling the ICC out on all their nonsense, and it was quite entertaining viewing. And the most ironic part of that for me is that there were so many entertaining games at that qualifier that they could have used those really entertaining games at the World Cup in a few months' time. Like, we could be talking about these games forever etched in World Cup history, but instead they're kind of all locked away in a qualifier for the event. But you are quite right, Tim, talking about, I guess, the pressures that full members had never really experienced before. I mean, who can forget the West Indies playing Scotland and how that could have ended up so much differently. And then at the end of the game, Scotland, who were rightfully aggrieved about what transpired on that particular day, were there sort of having a chat and a drink with the West Indian players, who probably knew at that stage that they got out of jail in that situation. But yeah, I bring it back to the word that starts with the letter P and ends with arity.
Are you plugging your parity chart again?
You know what, I might. But a team like Sri Lanka, I can see a team like Sri Lanka just crumbling against an associate member on any given day. And they're, you know, rankings aside, they're not the worst one-day international team in that group of 10. Obviously, you add Afghanistan and Ireland to that group of 12 now full members. But I think, yeah, on another day, like had a team like Sri Lanka been in the World Cup qualifier, I reckon they could have struggled and they so easily could have missed out on not qualifying for a Cricket World Cup. For me, it would have been interesting had the West Indies not qualified for that World Cup, and it could have so easily happened, and that would have left the entire International Cricket Council sort of red-faced. And a lot of people that say, oh, you know, you need the West Indies for successful international cricket. I don't necessarily agree with that sentiment. I think that's kind of a little bit romantic. But yeah, again, all of these conversations, and hopefully this series kind of uncovers it again between UAE and Zimbabwe, that close results might, again, prove to the ICC that there's more than 10 teams playing this game, and that would only be a good thing. So hopefully we see a really competitive series. Anyway, I digress after another one of my rants. That one was a bit more unplanned, so I do apologize if I went on a bit of a tangent. We'll get straight into the mailbag. Thanks so much to everyone who got involved. We opened up our podcast to you guys, the listeners, to see what you wanted answered on the show. All right, let's start with our first question comes from JWL80. He says, hi, love the show. What is the future, if any, of the Intercontinental Cup? Just to explain what the Intercontinental Cup is for those unaware, it was the four-day tournament that associate members played. It was sort of used as a bit of a stepping stone to full member in Test cricket that has been in limbo. Nick, just how good was the Intercontinental Cup?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was I'm a Test cricket tragic. So for me it was perfect. It was everything that I wanted cricket to be, you know. It was a round robin. All the teams played each other, you know, across the world. There was context. Every game mattered, and we talk about bilateral series and we talk about context, and a lot of the time, yeah, Test matches between four members can be fantastic matches in themselves, but without the broader context that the Intercontinental Cup had, they're just a little bit hollow. And I was lucky enough to go watch a few of them, and it was good cricket, you know. So I think this was one of the best things that's ever come out of the ICC, really.
Yeah, and remembering, you know, as much as we're talking about World Cricket League 2 and what it's leading into now, the new All ODI Cricket World Cup League 2, you know, used to be entwined with the I Cup, the World Cricket League Championship, and so was the funding. So for the I Cup, it was $325,000 a year, and World Cricket League Championship got $300,000 a year. So from that point of view, it was a good incentive for countries to be in that top eight, remembering that the last cycle had Afghanistan and Ireland included, and Hong Kong actually played against Afghanistan after they were made a Test nation. So that was quite a sight to see. Rashid Khan and Zahir Khan bowling his left arm leg spin as well was quite amazing. So, but the funding was always an interesting part of that as well. And I think go back and see what the coaches are saying even now that the future of the I Cup will be a potential pay to play, or at least a contribution of funds towards the event, considering how much the ICC are investing in this new white ball structure. So talking to Ryan Campbell recently on the Reddit AMA, where he's saying that he wants the Netherlands to participate in the future I Cup, despite there being no plans whatsoever to play Test cricket because of the match play experience that it gives the squad. So yeah, places in an interesting place where it used to be the pathway to Test cricket, and that was the way it was sold. It was the winner of the I Cup would play the bottom place Test team in a home and away playoff with the potential of getting test match status. But with that changing now, with the full member criteria not including anything to do with the iCup or and test match status being decoupled from full member status, it puts it in an interesting position of match or first class cricket experience and funding versus how actually useful it is in the context of how much cricket is being played and white ball cricket, especially being played by those top associates.
Yeah, and I guess just on the path to test cricket thing, it was very disappointing that I think they were calling it the test challenge or something like that. That seemed to disappear with Afghanistan and Ireland's promotion. So it was almost like that was only really there as a bit of a fig leaf for trying to get them up to full member status anyway. So, yeah, it's a bit sad that they've essentially pulled the ladder up after Afghanistan and Ireland when, you know, Scotland and, you know, a whole host of other teams are really snapping at their heels. And I guess just on the idea of a pathway, it really would have been great if they could have merged, you know, test cricket as we know it now with the iCup, just to bring a bit of a bit of context to international cricket, which is, yeah, always better.
So to come back to the question, the answer as to what the future of the iCup is, it is sort of in the balance. The ICC doesn't really sound truly committed to the event, although they have asked for, I guess, expressions of interest from the various associate countries. A lot of them have expressed desire to play in the iCup, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're interested in playing test cricket. And we're also not really sure what the funding for that is going to be, whether it's a sort of pay-to-play competition. So it is hanging in the balance, but the ICC haven't ruled it out yet, though they've kind of hedged their bets in that they haven't really committed to a competition of its nature either in the future. So, yeah, the jury's still out on that one, and we're not too sure how that's going to go. It does seem that everyone is focused on the limited overs forms of the game. Our next question comes from a friend of the podcast in PJ Hutals. Thank you very much, PJ. Ideally, how many franchise T20 leagues should there be? Would you like to see more regional / combined leagues such as the hashtag Eurothrash? That's the name that Bertus de Jong coined for the European T20 slam. He then continues to ask, perhaps a combined USA/Canada league, or even BBL teams, absorbing New Zealand teams. It is a tricky one because there are a lot popping up now. We've seen Canada with its own T20 tournament as well, which will return for 2019. It seems it's kind of a first in best dressed situation at the moment where everyone's trying to get T20 leagues up and running to sort of fit within the year moving forward and the calendar years over the next few years. Where do you think the ideal sort of perfect middle ground is between franchise T20 leagues and international cricket? Tim, I'll start with you.
Very good question. I think you could look at this two ways. You could say, what would you like to change now to get to the perfect situation? Or if you could scrap it and start all over again, how would we do it? Well, we can't scrap it and start all over again, where you'd probably have something a lot more global that has links with chances for local players to feature more in local leagues, and where there's less of a situation where the same players are going around to leagues and taking up the majority of the spots. But the way that I see it, and we use the USA question as a great example, is that I think the only way that a USA T20 league is going to work if it's a Pan-American league that goes throughout the Caribbean and North America to create a true, let's call it Major League Cricket. I know they've used that term before, that can really capture an entire
that one really continent. Died to death, didn't it?
Yeah, continent and a bit, because we've got to think that the candle is burning at both ends in terms of T20 cricket, space on television screens, pop-up tournaments with similar owners. You know, what does it actually bring into the game? You know, who is actually benefiting here? You know, the countries that they're being hosted, are they actually making money, or is it actually using their resources so they can't be concentrated on actually growing the game beyond running some T20 tournaments? Is it bringing new fans to the game, or is it just giving more cricket to the existing fans? There's so much to to consider there. Having the same owners of the Canada and the Euro Leagues brings an intriguing possibility. And I think we mentioned it when it was first launched as to whether there could be a Northern Hemisphere link between the two in time. I know it's the English Rugby League, isn't it, that has a Canadian franchise. So,
look, yeah, the Toronto Wolfpack.
Yeah, the Wolfpack. So it's a tough one because we've got private owners in all these places. It's not, you know, an internationally owned league. It's not Hong Kong Sevens. It's not Sevens Rugby where there are countries playing. It's a real tough one. Sorry, I've kind of talked around circles a bit there, but the BBL absorbing New Zealand teams, you know, that there's another one there as well. You know, how would the game benefit by having expansion teams in New Zealand? You know, the same as the BBL expanding into Asia. I think the big question is, you know, how long can is the pie getting bigger, or are there just more slices of it in terms of T20 cricket? And that's the question I think these regions need to ask themselves when they get together. And I think the Euro Thrash, the Euro Slam, is a great example of what can be done with some enterprising, and in a position where they need to be enterprising, but with three boards getting together. And we'll be interested to see what America comes up with. But PJ, thank you for your feedback on the podcast as well. Hopefully we're keeping you entertained, but I didn't really answer that. I sort of talked around the issues I think I see with the whole situation of T20 cricket. What do you reckon, Nicholas?
Well, you've done a pretty comprehensive job of talking about the issues, but yeah, I broadly agree with you. I think it is tricky because I guess the problem ultimately is that cricket, through a long and winding history, has developed so that international cricket is the primary form of the game, and the bilateral touring model is the most lucrative. And, you know, that's perhaps starting to shift with these private leagues, but and that's sort of where the tension is. You know, you look at other sports and it's primarily local leagues with, you know, international games as a sort of a special event and not the main form of the game. So perhaps cricket is going to just go towards that, where, you know, international cricket takes a backseat to local leagues, which I think would be a bit sad, but, yeah, that's definitely a possibility. In terms of, I guess, answering the question, yeah, I think regional and combined leagues work well when they're within fairly close geographical distance. So the US and Canada League, you know, both of those countries are roughly the size of Australia, and the Canadian League had to play all of its games in one ground because they couldn't afford to be flying people all over Canada to, you know, Vancouver and Toronto and back. So I imagine it would be the same thing with the US League. You know, if you're adding another, you know, massive country, that's going to be another challenge to that. And so that's I guess a logistical problem. So the BBL absorbing New Zealand teams, I don't think is going to happen, and I don't think that's a good idea because New Zealand's got its own domestic, I guess, set up already. So just being swallowed up by Australia is not something that I think would be beneficial for them or for cricket in general.
I think it's a really good question because it all comes down to what the people or what cricket will ultimately try to want to be. And Nick made a really good point about how the international game has long been the, the predominant format of cricket in high profile, in top level cricket. But if you look to other sports, the club side of things is massive, and then you have these international windows. My thinking is that there are already T20 leagues being played out every year already that cannibalize potential viewers in their specific markets. And the BBL is one example of that, where the PSL actually started before the BBL finished, and there were players sort of overlapping between the two. Some players actually had contractual obligations with one of the two teams that they were a part of. I know Sandeep was one of them, where he actually went over to play. Oh, it was actually, sorry, the Bangladesh Premier League, because he was contracted to a team there. And then he had to go back to play in the BBL. And then he went to play in the PSL. So all these tournaments are overlapping in it. And it means that, you know, players can only play in one place at a time, unfortunately, as much as we'd love to clone Andre Russell right now, because the dude is a machine. But there's just got to be a happy medium where we can give ourselves time to play the required amount of international cricket, and then the ideal amount for, I guess, the marketing side of things and for the viewer side of things to fit the T20 leagues in as well. But as a result of all this, you're going to player welfare and player harmony needs to play a big part in this. I think this is a question that needs to be driven and answered by the players. I think the players, there will be a point where there's so much cricket on that, you know, players are just going to turn around and be like, we can't do this. Players now are taking time off because for some of them, the workload is too much. I know Shakib Al-Hassan took time off for a portion of, I think it was last year, where he missed quite a bit of cricket just because he was just exhausted from the workload. So because the players are ultimately the product and ultimately the future of the game, it's an answer that probably needs to come from them.
Yeah, that's a good point, Bez. We sit here talking about all these theoretical, you know, structures and whatever, but yeah, but ultimately, yeah, they're the ones who need to actually get out there and play.
And as you both touched on, it's, you know, the club versus country question again. I think as we get more context around the international game with the ODI Super League, World Test Championship, and hopefully, well, we've already seen a more coordinated pathway for women's and men's T20 World Cup events as well. But, you know, there's got to be space. So there's context in the international game, but there's also space for these private leagues. And I guess it goes to the question about the ICC and its control of international cricket and whether those ODI leagues and whatnot could be handled more centrally, and funds coming through from television rights or whatnot could be distributed from that sort of central pot, as opposed to the way it's done at the moment. You could allow countries to look at their domestic leagues and they make their money from that, and then there's a global pot. But again, there's obviously already full members making a lot of money from international cricket at the moment. So what, you know, about giving that money up, but knowing it's to develop the game. It's a, I don't know, it's the more and more cricket tournaments that pop up, this tension is sort of just getting greater and greater. And I'm not sure where it's going to break, but there's going to be a point soon, as you say, whether it's the players or whether it's the media rights, people are saying, well, there's no, you know, the value's going down here. More cricket doesn't mean more value. And it's actually devaluing the product as a whole. You know, we've got to take another look at this. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be any chance of slowing up at the way that the Pakistan Super League is growing in terms of getting back into Pakistan, and the Euro League's popped up. But then on the other hand, you know, the failure of the UAE T20X to get up. So I'm not sure if we've got to the end of the line yet, but that, yeah, that's that club versus country question for me that just keeps coming up.
Fantastic question, PJ. And yeah, we've tried our best to give you the best answer, but look, it's a million-dollar question that will have to be answered at some point for cricket to progress. PJ also asked, what would your ideal formats for the 50-over and T20 World Cups be? How many teams, groups, matches, and duration? We'll probably talk more about that during the World Cup at the end of May. Well, we call it the World Cup in inverted commas because... with 10 teams, I guess trophy. You can kind of get our answer from our shade at what is called the World Cup. For the record, I'd probably want at least 14 teams at both Cricket World Cups for both formats. And you're probably looking at four groups of four in a 16-team tournament, but that's with sort of little thought. That's just me right now thinking what would I'd like to see. What about you guys, just quickly before we move on to the next question?
Yeah, four groups of four, top two from each group go through to a second round where there's two groups of four, and then the top two from those both groups go into the semi-final. Nice and simple, and yeah, you still get a fair bit of cricket, but yeah, a lot more simple and a lot more inclusive.
I love Ross Degnan's 20 team. Four groups of five, top teams go through to the next round, and the second and third teams play off against each other across the sides of the draw, meaning that three out of five of each group have a chance to get through. So less of a chance of another 2007, dare we say it, happening again. And I think on the T20 World Cup, 24 teams, six groups of four with a similar format, but I don't like the kind of grading of teams against results in other groups to get out of that sort of six into an eight, i.e. trying to find another two. So you'd always go four groups of six, but then there's a lot of games of cricket there. But maybe using the same format as the 4x5 for 20 for both for me. But, you know, as we're sitting there talking about the World Cup qualifier before, I'm just thinking, imagine, you know, this happening on TV, you know, in a global event with Scotland almost beating West Indies. You know, this is the stuff that starts dynasties and gets people into the game. And the more teams we can get in a format that, I know this is exactly why we're actually on this podcast with them, the better. But, you know, those 20-team format I like is that there's two games played in a day in on the 50-over World Cup leading up to, you know, that first round, meaning that the event itself would be shorter than this World Cup, which would be longer than the 2015 one. So something that's shorter and gets out of the way.
Yeah, that's another problem in itself, isn't it? The refusal to schedule multiple games on the same day. But that's, I guess, that's a whole other can of worms with the, you know, the TV contracts involved. And
it's whatnot. Understandable. You have wanting to get your product out and keeping it there. But, you know, it's playing a place where you can have an earlier game and a later game and maybe some overlap. But also, where a lot of this stuff's going to, you're going to have a red button, aren't you, that you can choose what you want to watch. And if you get the context and you get the world wanting to watch it, then you've got the audience going to be watching either game. So, look, it's not an easy question with an easy answer. It's not a question with an easy answer by any stretch, but I don't know. I think there's a lot more that can be done. Let's leave it there.
Yeah, once again, PJ, thank you for your questions. Let's move on to Vane Holden at Vane20. His questions surround Ireland's T20 ability at the moment. He asks, what do you feel about Ireland's current T20 squad? How close are they to an optimal T20 team? Do they need an injection of youth? Should regular captain Gary Wilson take them to the qualifiers? Or should Paul Sterling continue? What of the bowling? Would they benefit taking on a less experienced leggy? Plenty to go through, boys. I'll start by saying that T20 cricket is Ireland's probably poorest format out of the three. I think that they're quite good in the 50-over format, and they've shown that they're obviously with their newfound test status, they've sort of added those feathers to the caps, and they're getting some, you know, some heartening results out of their test matches so far. I know they're 0-2, but there's still plenty to build on. I know that we did talk about this during the quadrangular series. They are a little bit behind probably the Scotlands and the Dutch at the moment. But I guess what Vane's asking is what do they need to do to reach the higher levels of T20 international cricket?
Yeah, a lot to work through with that question, Vane. How close are they to their optimal team? I think, like, honestly, I think they are pretty close because, yeah, their depth has been a bit of a worry. As we saw, you know, in the quadrangular series and against, you know, that bilateral series against Afghanistan, you know, Kevin O'Brien at the top was a good move. Andy Balburnie looked really good as well. Dockrell, as a bit of a hitter, seems to be developing nicely, but they do look a bit thin, don't they? In terms of the captaincy, I've never been a huge fan of Gary Wilson. I think he's been sort of almost maybe a passenger in the team for a while now, which I'm sure he's going to go turn around and score bulk runs now that I've said that. But I'd be pretty okay with Wilson with Sterling just taking over the captaincy. But then I guess who do you replace Wilson with, really? And this has been Ireland's problem as the, I guess, golden generation start to retire. You know, who do you replace them with? And there's some promising talent, but Lorcan Tucker's looked okay, and, you know, Cameron Dow's looked okay, but, you know, I think they're going to have a lot of trouble replacing some of these guys.
I think we really need to see some of those younger guys coming through getting a chance for us to come up with a proper answer as to seeing what's behind. I thought we saw how Simi Singh was used in that T20 series, which I think had us all a little bit confused as to what his role is. You know, be great if every team had a Rashid Khan or a Majeeb, but they don't. But, you know, I think thinking about their spin bowling options is going to be key in T20 cricket. But I guess that's the beauty of what the Euro T20 Slam will be. There'll be a chance for some of these players that wouldn't necessarily have been getting first team experience will be able to play in the Irish franchises, with it looking like local players from each of those three countries will only be apportioned to those local teams. So I guess that's where we see an advantage with franchise T20, as we did in Hong Kong and other countries where players outside the national sphere get a chance. I guess it'll be a good question to answer after the Slam's on and before the T20 World Cup qualifiers.
Going straight to that last question that you asked, Vane, in terms of bringing in a leg spinner, I don't think the risk is worth the reward. I know that a lot of the top ranked bowlers in T20 cricket at the moment are leg spin. But I still think that you need to find, I guess, the quality to deliver that. It's not as if, you know, leg spin bowling is a cheat code at the moment, as much as the guys at the top do make it look like it is. Dockrell and Cameron Dow can theoretically do the same thing, and that's spinning the ball away from the right-hander. And given that, well, predominantly most cricketers are right-handed with the bat in hand, I think Dockrell and Cameron Dow should be able to do a similar job, if not the same job, theoretically, as a lot of those top leg spin bowlers. It's not just the idea of having, you know, wrist spin as your ultimate key to win, as much as, you know, some of these teams are kind of showing us. I thought Sterling, in sort of Wilson's absence, did a pretty decent job as the captain of the side. Whether or not that's a conversation Irish cricket are having right now remains to be seen. But yeah, I don't think they are far away. I think it just might be a consequence of perhaps focusing on their test playing, on their two test matches that they've played so far. Let's head into the next question, and it's from the 30-yard circle on Twitter. Thank you very much. Just quickly, what do we think about the 100? I'll start by showing my disapproval, and I won't really say much more than that. I will add, though, that it looks as though the ECB are relaxing the visa situation for potential players in that tournament, and so that might affect or might help emerging cricketers play in that competition, which could be a good thing. And if it does unearth, you know, some good talent, then by all means, it might be a positive. But overall, I'm not entirely a huge fan, and I can't see you two being fans either.
Oh, Tim. I was going to wait for Nicholas to fulminate similarly, and then for me to be the voice of reason or treason. But look, I don't hate it. I think there's a lot of unnecessary changes that have been made in terms of overs and whatnot. I think that the whole angle of attack here is skew. If you're trying to bring new people to the game, trying to fit as much cricket in as possible into a time frame, I don't think is the way to do it. We saw the effect of this at the T10 tournament the first year, when instead of using the shorter game time as an opportunity to have more entertainment and more of a kind of a carnival atmosphere. And I know in the UAE, generally it's just career cricket anyway, but we saw that with them going back-to-back, where people got a little bit tired, and the year after they played fewer games during the day. And I liken it to an experience of an NBA match or a baseball, well, not baseball, more sort of NFL match as well, where it's the game time isn't necessarily that long, but there's a lot of stoppages. I'm not saying that it should be that much, but which gives... there's entertainment, there's engagement opportunities, and people to actually talk about what's going on. Simply having whatever it's going to be, 2¾ hours of cricket smashed in as much as possible, I don't think is the way of bringing new people to the game. I think you could have had a T10 event played over that longer time with some other gaps in play, rather than just cramming it all in. I can see what they're trying to do and trying to fit into a slot that will fit free-to-air TV, and the fact that cricket is going to be back on free-to-air television in the UK is probably the most important bit of all of this. I know there's going to be some international cricket as well, but I just think they've missed it by a little bit by trying to cram too much cricket in that time?
Well, I hate it.
I'm cool to leave it at that.
You really could. I mean, just so much about this venture is just absolute nonsense, really. You know, the logic that somehow people who aren't interested in cricket, you know, you cut, what is it, 20 balls out of the game and suddenly they're going to, oh, yeah, I'll give it a go. Or you know, some of the statements that have come out around the marketing have been, frankly, absurd. You know, they're trying to appeal to a new audience, but they've got stars like Root and Stokes allocated to teams for marketing purposes only. But then that's okay that they don't play because nobody knows who Root and Stokes are anyway. So there's all this sort of nonsense going on. And I saw a theory that it's more to do with, I guess, internal English cricket politics than anything else, in that by making a new format, they can sort of marginalise the counties and basically direct all the money straight into ECB coffers. And I think that's probably a large part of what's going on. But, I mean, I think the visa stuff is potentially interesting, and that's good that they're relaxing it for this tournament, but I don't think they should have that restriction for any of their other tournaments, really. Like, there's no reason someone like, I think, what was it, Anshi Rath, Tim, that wanted to play in county cricket but couldn't get a visa for it?
Well, it's not a matter of he wanted to. Middlesex wanted to sign him and they wanted to go ahead, but, they weren't able to because the visa laws themselves say you have to play for a full member.
Yeah, so, you know, there's no reason for that to be a rule. What else is going on here? The whole tone of it, I think, was just completely tin-eared. They're saying that, you know, cricket is... It's sort of like this weird inferiority complex almost, where they're saying that cricket is... On the one hand, it's too complicated for you stupid plebs to understand, so we're going to give you this dumbed-down version. But on the other hand, they're saying, oh, well, it's too good for you. So, yeah, it's just the whole way they've gone about it has been a disaster, really. And maybe the format itself will be okay, but if you're trying to attract new fans, why are you going to make the game more complicated with all this, you know, 5-ball and 10-ball overs and all this nonsense? So, yeah.
I really wish you'd speak honestly sometimes, Nicholas. You know, I don't think you've really got your point across. And look, the way it was delivered will be a test case researched as to how not to do in marketing, you know, and then to say that they went to the players and did focus groups when they had spoken to three or four, you know, that was fairly, well, tin-eared, you said, ham-fisted, that whole part of it. I guess I agree with you there, the way that was communicated and the way, you know, how patronising it's come across about talking about mums and kids like they're a different sector of humanity when, you know, cricket has been underpinned by if we want to call them mums, you know, for so long that are making decisions about the sport that, you know, that it's they're just another parent, you know, or key people and caregivers. It's like they're not different, you know, they're already coming to the cricket. Yeah. You know, they're the ones bringing the kids to cricket. They're the ones packing collectively as parents, packing bloody picnics so they can go and watch. So that was really frustrating. That to me, as you say, you know, just showed this weird inferiority complex that the game has, that the nuanced beauty of the sport in its purest form, which I know you will say is test cricket, and I think we'll all agree, but even in the shorter but longer formats of the shorter game, it's like there's nothing for us to be bashful about here. We can't try and make our game more like another sport so people like it. You know, what is that actually doing? And if it brings more people to the game, then cool. You know, I'll have tomato sauce on my hat, please. But I agree with you that it's just ham-fisted around taking 20 balls there. I can see what they're trying to do, and I think that's what they got right. They're trying to fit into a certain time frame. But, no, look, I won't say that you converted me, but I'm on your side of the fence there. It's more me looking – I'm putting my administrator's hat back on, just shaking the dust off and just seeing – trying to see the strategy behind it, which I can see strategy just been executed in a way that I think they wish they would do differently or would have done differently in retrospect.
I am going to come down with the gavel and say that we're done with talking about the 100 for the next forever. Okay. After that, I can't be a huge fan. I just don't understand how you can have already be one of the few sports to have three formats of your sport and decide, you know what, let's just have a fourth. You know, why not? But yeah, fantastic answer, boys. I don't know what to make of the tournament at all, but we'll see what happens. Just a couple more before we end today's show. Danny Boy at DizzyDan015 asks, what six teams do you think will qualify for next year's T20 World Cup? Also, do you think that the Women's T20 and ODI World Cups should be expanded to more teams? Had a bit of a look at this today myself. Obviously, we're sort of halfway through men's qualification and women's qualification at the moment for the respective tournaments, but I guess looking at who's kind of expected to really perform, you're probably looking at the usual suspects from the men's side of things. The Scotlands, the Netherlands, I thought are two standout teams at this level of the game in T20 cricket. Zimbabwe, providing they get their stuff together. I think Ireland will have enough about them. And then you're looking at teams like Hong Kong, Oman, UAE, PNG, and then there's teams still yet to qualify. I would like to say, though, that from the women's side of things, despite the tournament having quite a different format, it will be very interesting to see if Thailand have enough about them to qualify. They've shown that they've accounted for themselves extremely well. They're high up on the T20 international rankings at the moment. How much thought have you put into this, boys? I know we've got bigger fish to fry early on, but if we were to sort of cast our minds to the future, what do you think we can see in a year's time in Australia?
Yeah, I think you pretty much covered it on the men's side. You know, Scotland, Netherlands, I think they're shoo-ins. I mean, not that, you know, anything's certain in associate cricket, but as far as there are certainties, I think Scotland and Netherlands should definitely make it through. You know, you've got six places, so, you know, Zimbabwe, Ireland, Hong Kong, Oman, UAE, PNG. Fighting for those last four spots is going to be the interesting one. But, yeah, Zimbabwe should make it through. They've got a lot of quality players. I think PNG will sneak in there. The USA, actually, I think, might be dark horses, though. They've as we've seen, they've got a very impressive side, and I think they might pull a few upsets.
Yeah, thank you for bringing them up. I would have, probably added them. Because there are two qualifiers that come from that side of things. So Canada would actually be involved in qualification two, theoretically.
Why do you hate Nepal? Yes.
Why do I hate Nepal?
Yeah, you haven't even mentioned it.
Well, they got to get through the Asian. They got to get through the Asian qualifier first. I definitely do not hate Nepal. I think that's been rested on Twitter. Thank you very much. No, it's a fair question. They got one of the best T20 international spin bowlers in the world, I guess. So it's a long way. It's a long way away. And, you know, we've been doing all this form about World Cricket League too. So I haven't really given it too much thought. But I will say that Scotland and the Netherlands have probably more well-balanced teams than Nepal anyway right now. And USA have a bit of X factor about them. And yeah, once again, just got to get through the banana skin that is that Asian qualifier, given that UAE are already through, given that they are hosting the event too. It doesn't give as much insurance to Nepal as that they probably would have liked in that Asian qualifier. So it's probably a little bit too early to talk about them just yet. I'd probably have to wait until they get through their qualifying.
Yeah, I'm going to say those four: Scotland, Netherlands, Zimbabwe, Ireland, USA, and UAE. There you go. There's my six.
All right. Well, if we're doing predictions, then yeah, Scotland, Netherlands, Zimbabwe, Ireland, USA, and PNG.
And to give you my six, I'll go Scotland, Netherlands, Zimbabwe, Ireland. Let's go USA, and we'll go Nepal. There we go. Now I'm back on the Nepal.
You don't hate Nepal.
No. I think that, yeah.
If the Nepalese fans got this far through, then they got what they're waiting for.
So for the women's, though, I think it's wide open. You know, we've got two spots up for grabs. And Bangladesh, I think, showed last qualifier they have the quality to do it again. But then that last spot, you know, Ireland, Scotland, Thailand, I think will be, you know, fighting out presumably Zimbabwe from Africa, but you never know. The PNG women have developed nicely as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of teams fighting for that last spot behind presumably Bangladesh. Heart says Thailand.
Yeah, I think we all want Thailand, don't we?
Yeah, I'm all about it.
Bangladesh and Thailand, there we go. That's what we all say. If we're going to be making predictions.
At Urajan 007, I'm assuming he's a big James Bond fan, so good on you. Oman and PNG, are they much improved sides? Which country seems more prepared for WCL2? I'd probably just say Oman, given that they've played slightly stronger opposition in 50-over cricket, plus their T20 cricket as well. PNG coming off their World T20 campaigns. There is more to it than that. There are, you know, with PNG preparing in South Africa and Oman playing UAE as well. So, yeah, I'd probably go with Oman, but I think, you know, both teams could easily end up on similar points come the end of World Cricket League 2.
Yeah, I think that's a good little summary there. Like, they've both had good programs with a lot of cricket and a lot of time together. You've got to say Oman's better for the context of World Cricket League 2 with a lot more 50-over cricket within that. And I guess PNG, it's strange that you'd say that, but they're more consistent in terms of performers across the squad. And like you're talking about in part one, that, you know, they've been able to pick the same squad more or less than they've had over the last 2-3 years. But that's a good question, actually. I'd be intrigued as to why Erijan has brought out Oman and PG in particular. But much improved. I think Oman's definitely the one that's much improved, coming from where they have World Cricket League Division 5, were they not, in two cycles ago? So to come up like they have to win a game in a world event is no mean feat, where PNG, despite getting so close on a number of times, have not been able to make their inaugural full-age group global event. So, no, it's a good question. And two teams will be interesting to see up against each other.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I guess which one's more prepared is, it seems like PNG had a lot of their preparation rained off during that East Asia Pacific qualifier. Yeah, so, yeah, I guess in terms of preparation directly, I would agree Oman's definitely had a lot more match practice. But much improved, yeah, I agree with Tim again. Definitely Oman. PNG, I wouldn't say stagnant, because that's really unfair, but I would say that they're consistent, and they perhaps haven't taken that next step up that they would have liked to.
And finally, the last question of the night, boys, again from the 30-yard circle. He's talking about World Cricket League 2 once again. He asks, are you streaming at World Cricket League 2? I can answer that with no, but we'll explain a little bit more after. And also asks, which four teams do you wish to qualify? So not necessarily the teams that we think will qualify. In saying that, it is pretty hard to show some sort of favoritism in who I wish to qualify from the six. They all, you know, put in, you know, an unbelievable amount of effort to be in this position and to move their respective cases in cricket moving forward. I would like to see a PNG move into that top four. And I think the story of the USA might just be a beneficial one for cricket, but again, you can see, I guess, pros and cons for all six, boys. What do we make of that? And Tim, do you want to tackle the streaming question?
Yes, thank you, Bez. Hearing a few different things from different sources, I think fans may be pleasantly surprised that there'll be something. Details are still a bit hazy at this stage, and little bits have been told in confidence as well. So, I think we're going to have more than we did at the last World Cricket League event, if we can put it that way. Who do I wish to qualify? That's a tough one as well. Even having been involved in Hong Kong cricket.
Hong Kong!
it's a real tough one. Like, I think, Bez, you nail on the head in terms of what it means for PNG as a pathway for the hundreds of thousands of kids that play the game. To have something to aspire to over the next few years of that much ODI cricket, USA, for reasons that are obvious if you've got this far of even these two podcasts. The number of players in Canada as well and what that could mean. And Nick, maybe you're better to talk about what inroads the game has made and where these games will be played and what it could actually be done to use to grow the game more. Yeah, and Namibia, you'd like to have an African outpost and associate cricket. It's kind of like, well, can't we have all of them? So I don't really have anyone that I wish to. And there's, I guess, in the other way around, there's none I wish not to qualify. Because if you start putting on the troll hat and talk about, oh, the expats, and go, oh, look at Oman, you know, there's only one guy born. It's like, well, look at the work that Oman have been doing to grow the game in the Sultanate for the last 5 years. The infrastructure development, the junior courses they've been doing. They've flown people from around the world to come over and appear as celebrities to try and get the local population involved in the game. So they're trying as hard as they can to grow the game. They're not doing it just for trophies. The guys that are running the game have more money than some of the banks we know of. So they're not doing it for their personal gain there. So, you know, if people want to try and cast aspersions to some of these teams, I think they've come to the wrong place here. You know, all of them have reasons to qualify. So, good question, but yeah, you're not going to get an answer out of me.
That was a very long-winded way of saying no comment.
very unlike me, wasn't it?
Well, I'm going to answer the question because I'm a Canadian and I want Canada to qualify. And yeah. In terms of other teams, yeah, as you're saying, Tim, I'd really like Namibia to qualify. Not just for having the African, I guess, outpost, but because, yeah, they've always been sort of there or thereabouts, but they've never really had the consistent exposure to top level cricket that would be really helpful for them. So I think Namibia qualifying would be very good for the game there and more broadly in Africa.
All right, boys, I think we'll end it there for tonight. It has been a bumper show, this one, episode lucky 7 of the Emerging Cricket Podcast. And luckily for all the listeners, wherever you are listening to this, you've got it in two parts as well. So double the fun in this last show before we all head over to World Cricket League 2 in Namibia next week. Looking forward to that, boys, as I'm sure you are as well. So, I'll, you know, I guess the next time I'll be speaking to you, gents, it will be in another country. So I'll see you soon.
Yes, yes, indeed. See you next week, Bez.
Looking forward to it. And I think I'll just thank everyone for getting through this bumper session. It is well after midnight here. So if I'm a little off the boil, then forgive us. But looking forward to bringing the joy, the trials, tribulations, and Jesus, I think there's going to be some tears in Namibia. I'm just hoping they're happy ones for some of the teams. But no, really looking forward to the three of us being down there and bringing World Cricket League 2 to everyone. So if you've got any ideas or requests, feel free to hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or even Instagram. Like we've done with the mailbag, you'd even put it in there. But we definitely read all the tweets that come in, so please keep them coming.
Yeah, not much to add. Just thanks for sitting with me, guys. It's been a long, 4 or 5 hours now almost recording this. So, yeah, hopefully we can get to bed and have a bit of a rest now.
Yeah, once again, boys, thank you very much for joining me, and thank you to all the listeners who did get through the multiple hours of cricket coverage tonight. It is it means a lot to us, so we do thank you. And looking forward to next week, where we will bring you coverage from World Cricket League 2. So to keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favorite social media platforms. For now, from us, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world. Yeah, time.